From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Do you have to believe in the Bible's miracles to be a Christian?
The only reason for paying any attention at all to Jesus is if you believe that he is the Son of God who rose from the dead. If you accept the supernatural basis of it, it all fits together very well.
If faith is not based in what is true, then we're really in trouble. The religious life, for me, is best characterized as seeking. And faith is distorted, I think, when it's presented to us as blind obedience and authoritarianism.
Two historians square off in the continuing debate over Jesus and whether the historical Jesus matters to Christian faith. Today we'll talk about belief and unbelief and how history and science stack up next to religion. We'll also sit down with famed biologist E.O. Wilson. He describes his own transformation from Christian fundamentalist to secularist and why he thinks the clash between science and religion is the great problem of our time.
That's the dilemma of the 21st century. You could say that we evolved to accept one truth, you know, the religious instinct, but then discovered another. And having discovered another, what are we to do?
Gary Wills is one of America's leading historians, an expert on the classical world as well as the United States. His book, Lincoln at Gettysburg, won the Pulitzer Prize. But this is just one of the hats he wears. Wills once studied for the priesthood, and he remains a devout Catholic. His new book is called What Jesus Meant. It's a curious book, because Gary Wills, the eminent historian, says history has little relevance to being a Christian.
There are very few historical facts about Jesus. What we have is the New Testament. And if that is convincing to you, you have to read it in the light of its intention, its place in the church. The people who created the New Testament were believers in Jesus and in his resurrection. St. Paul, of course, was the first before the Gospels ever came along. He adduces 500 people who saw the risen Jesus, and he saw him and writes about him at great length. And the Gospels are written by followers at a later date, between 20 and 50 years later. They are explications of that faith that Paul and the other people testified to. And believers in Jesus, and I am one, are studying that faith. Jesus does not really exist outside the New Testament, outside Paul and the Gospels. Some people, of course, try to extract a historical Jesus from the New Testament. They have to do it by eliminating everything that they don't want. They assume that there really was a man, Jesus, and he did do things and say things, but later people added all the miracles and prophecies and all of that kind of thing, and we just take that away and we get the historical Jesus. But, of course, their source is the New Testament, and the things that they think are authentic are only there because they're part of the large picture that was put together by the church.
So this really puts you at odds with the whole historical Jesus movement that has been going on in recent years, the attempt. I'm not sure that I understand why they feel they need to take things out, and as though some things were facts and some weren't. I mean, why not just throw the whole thing out if you're going to throw some of it out?
Of course, that's what I think they should do. But this is an old, old effort. People who liked what they liked in Jesus, they liked to have him say, be kind to people, love your enemies, say various things of that sort. They just couldn't believe in miracles. So they figured that if you just got rid of the miracles, he would be a wonderful ethical teacher.
This is, again, kind of in the realm of faith rather than of fact, because what you're doing is talking about, and perhaps this is the logical thing, you're talking about a being who is so completely different from mankind than that he is unique in the history of the world, which takes you away from history then, doesn't it?
Certainly. It is a revelation. Revelation always takes you away from history. If you believe that God can reveal himself to people, that's not going to come from the creation. That's perhaps another form of revelation of God. But this is a specific intervention into history by the divine. And if you don't believe that, then of course the whole thing makes no sense. But the only reason for paying any attention at all to Jesus is, if you believe, that he is the Son of God who rose from the dead. If you accept the supernatural basis of it, it all fits together very well. You know, you say we should consider facts. Well, the facts here are the faith of the original people. Did they act as if they had seen Jesus? Did they turn from cowards into brave people? Did they convince each other? And how did they do that? Paul says that it's because the tomb was empty, nobody found the body. He appeared to us, our lives were changed, and so the fact is this kind of eruption of a new religion.
Do you, Gary Wills, accept the supernatural basis of the revelation?
Of course. I wouldn't be a Christian if I didn't.
There are people who say that they are Christians who don't, and who certainly say it with passion and with inherent honesty as far as they see. Are they not Christian?
No, I don't think so. The question is not sincerity or passion. The test has been around for a long time. The test is the creed. Do you believe in the creed? There are several early creeds. They all say the same thing. And they were defended by the early councils of the church. And they lay out what it means to be a Christian. If you don't believe the creed, why should you consider yourself a Christian?
But the searchers for the historical Jesus, who are removing the miracles from the story in order to find the person who lived at that time, are they then not Christian because they reject the miracles?
I don't think they even call themselves Christians. They call themselves students of the Jesus phenomenon. They're not Christians. They don't claim to be.
It seems to me that the crux of the problem that many people have comes with the subject of resurrection. You believe in the resurrection of Jesus 3 days after his crucifixion.
Yes, I do. All Christians do, because that's in the creed.
Reading the arguments that you make about who Jesus was and what he meant, there are elements that suggest that those who claim Jesus as the source for modern political movements are not reading the real Jesus. Those, in fact, of the modern church are in many cases not reading the real Jesus. Is that correct?
Oh, of course. The New Testament sets out what Jesus meant. And the people that try to use Jesus politically, or ecclesiastically for that matter, are going against the plain, clear word of the text. For instance, we're told by the religious right that we as a nation have to profess belief in God and pray to God, or God won't protect us. Well, that goes against what Jesus said in many ways, and couldn't have said more plainly. He says, for instance, in the Gospel of Matthew, "When you pray, do not do it in public like the pretenders. Go into your house and lock the door, and in hiding ask your Father for what you need. And in hiding your Father will give you what you need." Public prayer is against what he said. He was against the establishments of religion of every kind. He said to his followers, again in the Gospel of Matthew, "Do not be called Father, you have only one Father in heaven. Do not be called Rabbi, you have only one teacher. Do not seek office over your fellows." He's a radical egalitarian.
This would throw out just about all modern religious establishments, though, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would.
Including the Catholic Church, of which you have been a member.
Well, including the hierarchy of the Catholic Church. He also says, "Where two or three are gathered in my name, I am there." So the Christians who follow Jesus and do the few things that he said to do, like have a meal to commemorate him, whether they're Catholics or Methodists or Lutherans or Orthodox, they're all Christians. They're all followers of Jesus. And I am a follower of Jesus in the Catholic community. Some, you know, people have said to me, "You're no better than a Protestant." And I say, "My God, it's really that bad, eh?" And they say, "Why don't you go join them? They don't have a pope." I don't want to join them. I want all of us to join together. You know, the real scandal of Christianity is that we have had centuries of Catholics burning heretics and Protestants beheading Jesuits and Congregationalists hanging Quakers and Philadelphian Protestants burning convents. There could be nothing more an affront, a blasphemy, a devastation of the New Testament than this history of inter-Christian killing. You know, in the early days, according to the Acts of the Apostles, it said, these Christians are so amazing because they love each other so. Well, we have a horrible history of hating each other so.
There were also, of course, things that you talk about in the book that are of very significant modern discussion. The whole business of Jesus spending time with the unclean, and you're pretty broad in describing who the unclean were, and or at least what the people of his time thought were the unclean.
That's right. It was a very broad category, and he broke through every one of the taboos against the unclean. Women were unclean if they were disheveled, if they were menstruating. Samaritans were unclean. The crippled and sick were unclean. That's why they were thought to be possessed. Jesus said, you scribes and Pharisees, you're all interested in the cleanliness of the cup. Clean yourself inside. It's not what you put into the mouth that makes you unclean. It's what comes out of your mouth that makes you unclean. Purity was within the heart. So in saying that, he embraced everybody. There's no lowly person lowly enough for him not to embrace. That's why it's so astonishing to hear now that we have unclean people like homosexuals whom we must hate. You know, we have so-called good Christians going to the funerals of people who die of AIDS and chanting, God hates fags. Well, in his day, they said, God hates Samaritans, God hates tax collectors, God hates prostitutes. And he mingled with them all. So the people who are chanting that are chanting against Jesus, who's lying in that grave.
That's Gary Wills, the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and devout Catholic. His latest book is called What Jesus Meant.
Yes, I can put all my trust in my Jesus. Oh, yes, can he put all my Lord, his trust in me.
Coming up, a very different view of early Christian history. We'll talk with an expert on the Gnostic Gospels. Also, E.O. Wilson on the growing rift between science and religion. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
When we've had a text or a set of texts like the New Testament for 2,000 years, they've come to us interpreted. And so it's very hard for people to read them fresh.
That's Harvard Divinity School historian Karen King, one of the world's leading experts on early Christianity. She says history does matter to faith, especially when you read some of the conflicting stories about Jesus that circulated after his death. Only a few of those stories made it into the Bible. Karen King told Anne Strangechamps that the other stories, the lost stories, give us a fuller understanding of what it means to be a Christian.
Part of what I do, of course, is look at the broad shape of early Christianity, not just those materials that made it into the canon, but also these new discoveries we have. And for me, what they do is they allow us to hear alternative voices. They allow us to read the Bible fresh, if you will.
When you talk about new discoveries, you're talking about the Dead Sea Scrolls?
When I talk about new discoveries, I'm thinking mostly of Christian texts we've discovered in Egypt over the last century or so, primarily a set of materials discovered at a place in Middle Egypt called Nag Hammadi. There, a peasant found a set of 13 papyrus books hidden in a jar in the desert. And these are really revolutionizing our notions of what Christianity looked like, especially in the 2nd to 4th centuries. These are mostly early Christian texts that show us the path not taken. In a way, the winners get to tell the story their way, you know, and silence other voices. And these texts are giving us, or restoring to us, some of those alternative lost voices.
Do these new texts cover some of the most standard ground of the New Testament? I mean, for instance, take the story of the resurrection. How many different versions of the resurrection are there?
Oh, I'd have to sit and think to count how many different versions of the resurrection. But the new texts do have some new accounts of the resurrection, but mostly they have new interpretations of what the resurrection is about. One of the most astonishing texts is one that Apocalypse of Peter, which suggests that the Jesus who was crucified on the cross is different from the cosmic Christ, the revealer. And it goes on to talk about the way that the body is not the self. Many Christians understood the resurrection of Jesus to be a spiritual resurrection.
I thought that was kind of a very recent way of interpreting the resurrection. I guess I thought that in the days of early Christianity, the resurrection was always understood to be a literal physical event, you know, that Jesus appeared in the flesh 3 days after his crucifixion.
I think this is one of the ways in which when we read the Bible, we already know what it says, so we read it into the texts. But if you look very carefully at what kind of body Jesus has when he rises from the dead, it walks through walls, he appears in locked rooms, the people closest to him in his life don't even recognize who he is. But the earliest accounts we have a very ambiguous body. One has to ask, what kind of body is this? From the very beginning, there were notions that the resurrection was a spiritual resurrection, not one that was a physical bodily resurrection.
Did early Christians all pretty much down the line believe that there was a resurrection?
I think that's pretty universal. And the question is only, what kind is it? With what kind of body will we rise? And even more than that, what does it mean? Why did God want his son to die and to be raised? What is the meaning of that? Those were the things that they were most interested in and debated very, very strongly.
Well, for centuries, one of the chief articles of Christian faith has been the belief that Jesus died to atone for the sins of humanity. Was that how it was always understood among those first early Christians?
You get that idea very early on because, of course, the Greco-Roman world is a world where the practice of sacrifice is very broadly practiced, and this notion of atonement comes in very early. But we can see that not everyone agreed. Not everyone thought that that was the proper way to understand the death of Jesus. And in particular, there were Christians who questioned whether a good and loving God would want his son to suffer such a cruel death.
Well, if they didn't interpret Jesus' death as a form of atonement for humanity's sins, then how did they interpret it? Why did Jesus die then?
One notion is to show that the powers of the world are not in control, that God is in control. Another kind of view is precisely to show that one should concentrate on the spiritual aspects of life and not on the physical. Jesus comes into this world as a revealer, and it's his teachings that bring salvation, not his death and resurrection.
You know, listening to you, I just have a glimpse of what an incredibly knotty, tangled thing it must have been for the early church fathers to codify Christian faith.
Well, it was a long process. One thinks of it happening over a period of 3 or 4 centuries. And of course, they only really come to a kind of an agreement when Constantine, the Roman emperor, converts, calls the bishops together and tells them to sit down and solve their difficulties. Now, part of it, of course, is only some people got invited. So they were already somewhat on the same page when they arrived, and they simply excommunicated anybody who disagreed.
Some of these things that we take as basic articles of faith, in fact, were very political decisions.
Yes, political in the sense that they were contested, that power relations was at stake, who was in charge, what communities would look like, who would be cast out as heretics, who would get to gain from Constantine, who gave a lot of financial aid in various kinds of ways to the churches. So yes, politics were involved, even though I think we don't want to reduce it to that.
This raises a fundamental question, don't you think, about how we should read the scriptures, and in particular, whether they can or should be taken literally. I mean, how do you sort out this question?
I think the question you raised about reading the scriptures is an important one, precisely because I think it's very hard to read the scriptures literally. We can look, for example, at the figure of Mary Magdalene. And most people, like myself, were raised with the notion that she was a prostitute. And now we're hearing that she wasn't, that this was something that was invented in the 5th century. We see it first in the sermons of Pope Gregory, for example. But my question is, why is it that nobody noticed that for 1,500 years, that the New Testament, which is our best and most reliable source about Mary Magdalene, doesn't say that she's a prostitute? Why did no one see that? Or, for example, in reading Genesis, I ask students to read it and close their Bibles and tell me what it says. And inevitably, they say Adam and Eve ate an apple, that the serpent was a snake, that the topic is original sin. And then I ask them to open their Bibles again. And sure enough, no apple, no snake is the devil. There's no language of original sin. It's because, you know, the apple comes from Milton and so forth. So people tend to know what the text says ahead of time and read it in. And again, I think this is one of the most important things that these new texts can do, is they can make us go back and look at the text and say, what does it really say about Mary Magdalene?
Why do you think the story of Mary Magdalene is important today? I mean, I know it's very hot, very popular right now, but does she matter?
Mary Magdalene matters for a number of reasons, because she's one of the most prominent women in the biblical story. And insofar as the biblical story shapes so much about how people see the world, what they think is appropriate, and the roles of women in general, then she becomes important. So insofar as she's seen as a prostitute, or we have Mary the Mother, the Virgin, Mary Magdalene, the repentant prostitute, and these are the models of femininity we have. Now with the Da Vinci Code, we have a new model, you know, Mary the wife and mother. But if we look historically, the role that we have the best evidence for is Mary Magdalene as a disciple and as an apostolic leader. And that, of course, makes a lot of difference. Instead of seeing women solely in terms of their sexuality, we can see women as spiritual leaders in their own right. The historical Mary Magdalene lets us have that and have that vision, that role model within Christianity for women's leadership in the church.
And then that raises, I think, an interesting question in terms of how do you then reconcile historical fact and faith? You know, I mean, what does it mean in this case to reclaim Mary Magdalene, to uncover the real historical facts about her? It's interesting historically, but is it interesting from a faith perspective?
I think it has to be. If faith is not based in what is true, then we're really in trouble. The religious life, for me, is best characterized as seeking. And faith is distorted, I think, when it's presented to us as blind obedience and authoritarianism, when one suggests that it's obvious what the Bible says, when it has been contested, and when, in fact, the interpretation of the Bible is precisely a place for the Christian to engage.
And what about for you personally? You're an observant Christian?
Yes, uh-huh.
And how do you connect your scholarly work and your own personal faith, or do those two connect?
Oh, they connect very clearly and very dramatically for me. I mean, the kind of work one does in history and in the study of theology and so forth requires a kind of honesty and courage to face the ambiguities and the contradictions in the tradition, not to settle for easy answers and authority instead of thoughtfulness and instead of evidence.
I want to go back to this question about the resurrection. I don't mean to belabor the point, but there are plenty of Christians today who would say that if you don't believe in the resurrection literally, you're not a Christian.
Yes, there are many Christians, I think, who would say that. But again, there's this assumption that if you affirm the physical resurrection, then what that means is also a settled issue. As though then one has to believe in the atonement theology. One has to have particular views that I would call homophobic, that one has to take particular views about women staying at home or women being subordinate to men, so on and so forth, that they come as a kind of a package. But authority never rests solely in Scripture, even despite such claims. But it's always invested in those the community decides can rightfully interpret them. So this notion that somehow Christianity is fixed and one idea is the central idea, and if you don't believe that, then you're out, belies the historical fact that Christianity has a history in which people have made choices. And it's simply not as straightforward, I would say, as that kind of you're in and you're out sort of statement would make it seem.
Karen King is a historian at the Harvard Divinity School. Her books include The Secret Revelation of John and What is Gnosticism? And Strainsham spoke with her. What do you think of the historical Jesus? Does history matter to faith? We'd like to know what you think. You can email your thoughts and comments to our website at www.ttbook.org. Now, for a completely different take on the Bible, we turn to those would-be biblical experts Reed Martin and Austin Titchener. otherwise known as the Reduced Shakespeare Company. They have their own version of Bible history, or at least a theatrical show called The Bible, The Complete Word of God, abridged, which, I might add, has enough stories to offend just about everyone.
In the beginning, everything was void. God saw all that emptiness. He really got annoyed. So he started his creating, because he knew he should. He said,
"Let there be light. Wow, that light is good."
So we got, anyway, that's the In the Beginning blues that start the show.
Yeah. God had a serious case of the In the Beginning blues.
Yeah. Well, and did a pretty good job of filling them in.
Yes. Well, and we have a whole song about begatten, you know, how the world was populated.
That's right.
But done tastefully.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I'd be grateful for that, actually. I mean, in the beginning section of the Bible, there are those long lists of names.
Now, Adam begat Cain, who begat Enoch, and then Irad. Mahujael, Methusael, and still he wasn't Tyred. Then Lamech, who begat Jabal and Jubal, who were brothers, and Tubal Cain and Naamah, and many, many others. Begatten, begatten, everywhere begatten, begatten like the bunnies like to do. They were begatten, begatten, making babies happen, because back then there was nothing else to do. So Adam begat Seth, who begat Enos, then Cainan, Mahalalel, and Jared, with no energy declining. Jared begat Enoch, because there was nothing to it. Methuselah is proof you never get too old to do it. Begatten, and et cetera.
Yes.
That's much more interesting than reading the list of names one right after the other.
From your mouth to God's ears.
Yes, well, thank you. All right, well, before we leave the Old Testament, I think we really have to talk about one of the great battle scenes of all time, don't you think?
Oh, yes.
Yes. Joshua fit the Battle of Jericho.
In his 120th year, Moses did die, so God appointed Joshua to become the new leader of Israel.
All right, men, hut, hoop. We're moving into Canaan at 0600 hours. We're going to hit the walls of Jericho and hit them hard. Our objective? Take back the land which our Lord God and Supreme Commander has given us. Sound off!
One!
Okay, that's enough. Gather around, it's time to go.
Gather around, it's time to go.
Kick some ass in Jericho.
Kick some ass in Jericho.
Listen up, now here's the news.
Listen up, now here's the news.
We're taking Israel back for Jews.
Taking Israel back for Jews.
No sound.
No sound.
No noise.
No noise.
Let's go down and kill Goys. Lift face. Forward march.
Well, Joshua did indeed bring the house down in Jericho and proceeded to kill audiences all over the Middle East. He slew the people of Midian, known as the Midianites, the people of Girgash, known as the Girgashites, and the people of Paris, known as the French.
Very nice. All right, well, that pretty much takes care of the Old Testament. I suppose you have to at some point go on and think about the New, or do you?
Yes, we do.
We have to think about
act.
It, for sure.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And actually, there's a fellow named Jesus who figures prominently in the New Testament.
And this was the guy we had to keep explaining when we performed in Israel.
Yeah.
Who he was, Son of God. You ever heard of him? Hands up. Anybody?
Yeah.
No. And actually, one of the things that we do, I mean, there are people who think the entire idea of doing a reduction of the Bible is a bad idea. But we, more so than in any of our other shows, we bent over backwards to not make fun of anybody's faith and really just, you know, do funny versions of the stories, of the tales. And this was particularly tricky when we were talking about Jesus, because there's not too much fun to make out of the guy. He was really a kind of a nice dude, you know?
Yeah.
So it was.
Well, and I don't know whether this is true or not, but it seems to me that the stories in the New Testament may actually be better known than many of the stories in the Old Testament.
Yeah. And, you know, how do we deal with it? We have a scene with the wise men getting lost in the desert because it's overcast. They can't find the star, and so they stop and they play catch, as they did.
Because they've bought presents for the baby Jesus.
Yeah, it turns out they all three bought him a baseball mitt.
Yeah, because it's his birthday, which falls on Christmas, so he
never
doesn't get very good presents.
You know, it's just not right. Yeah.
And then we did our research, and we found the letter that Jesus wrote to Joseph and Mary.
Oh, really?
Yes, when he went off on his own.
It goes, "Dear Mother and Joseph, I just don't feel I have what it takes to be a good carpenter, so I'm leaving to wander in the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights to, well, get my head together. Don't worry, I'll be fine. Love, your miracle, Jesus." Yes.
It's very touching.
Yeah, very moving.
I hadn't known that was found before.
Yeah, and in the scene we have, you know, Mary reading it out loud and Joseph being very bummed, and Mary says to Joseph, "Oh, don't worry, honey. He loves you. He loves everybody. Read the note."
Yeah.
So, you know, when you did The Complete Works of Shakespeare, you reduced all of the comedies to one. You said it really only has one plot, so mm-hmm. that was all there was. Mm-hmm. Anything like that in the Bible?
Actually, there is. There's all the letters, you know, Paul's letters.
Yes.
They basically say three things. These are instructions to early Christians. Two are written by Peter, four by John, 14 by Paul, and as far as anyone knows, nothing was written by either George or Ringo.
Okay, well, and what do they say?
They say basically three things. Love the Lord thy God. Love thy neighbor as thyself. And they say, women, you're responsible for the downfall of mankind, so shut up and obey your husbands.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that basically covers it.
Ooh, ouch.
Yeah.
That was our feeling. We didn't write it. We're just telling you what they say.
Yeah, don't blame the messenger. And then we launch into the big musical climax. That's Armageddon.
Yeah.
Austin Titchener and Reed Martin of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. Their show is called The Bible, The Complete Word of God, Abridged. Up next, renowned biologist E.O. Wilson on the clash between science and religion and why he's not at all sure he wants to go to heaven. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. For a man who's obsessed with tiny critters, Edward O. Wilson has a strange knack for stirring up controversy over life's biggest questions. The Harvard biologist is a renowned expert on ants, but it was his seminal 1975 book Sociobiology that laid the groundwork for the new field of evolutionary psychology. Wilson argued that many human behaviors, including violence and altruism, are shaped by evolution. This tilt toward nature in the age-old nature-nurture debate also made Wilson plenty of enemies. Some people accused him of providing the genetic justification for racism and Nazi ideology. Over the years, sociobiology has become a widely accepted branch of science, and E.O. Wilson himself is a revered scientist. Now in his mid-70s, he's just edited a collection of books by his great hero, Charles Darwin. He recently stopped by our studio to talk about how hard it is to reconcile science and religion, and why he renounced his Southern Baptist faith. Wilson's a vocal critic of intelligent design, which made Steve Paulson want to know,
if you fully accept the theory of evolution by natural selection, does that logically lead you to atheism?
Well, it does, up to the origin of the mind and spirit. And the Catholic Church, for example, has taken the position just recently, turning thumbs down on intelligent design, incidentally. John Paul II took the position that evolution has been proved pretty well and certainly was acceptable, as I suppose he would have put it, God's way of creating life. But the human soul was injected by God. So that's a kind of compromise position that a lot of devoutly religious people have taken.
But that's a funny position because the question is, when did the soul enter? I mean, you know, if you take evolution, at some point humans evolved out of something before, and does that suggest that all creatures have some kind of soul, or do only humans have a soul?
Yeah, of course. There is no reconciliation between the theory of evolution by natural selection and traditional religious view of the origin of the human mind.
Now, this is not a view that all scientists subscribe to. I mean, Stephen Jay Gould famously talked about how he considered science and religion to be two entirely separate spheres, and they really didn't have anything to do with each other.
Yeah, he threw in the towel.
He dodged the question.
He dodged the question famously. That's no answer at all. That's just evasion. And I think that most scientists who give thought to this with any depth, who understand evolution, take pretty much the position that I have taken.
Now, it would seem that religion and science have two entirely different ways of understanding the world. I mean, science is founded on reason and deduction and empirical study, and religion, on the other hand, is grounded in faith, often a leap of faith in the sense of mystery, in being comfortable with living with the non-rational part of your mind. And I guess the question is, are those just two utterly alien ways of looking at the world, or is there any common ground there?
The only common ground that I see is the one that I think was being approached by Darwin himself. Religious belief itself is an adaptation that has evolved, that we're hardwired to form tribalistic religions. And that's what religion is. It's intensely tribalistic. It binds people together. It gives them faith in the particular group to which they belong and that set of belief and moral values.
Now, we've talked about whether there's really any common ground between science and religion. And what about the sense of awe, of wonder? Certainly, that's something you hear about all the time among religious people. And you also hear about it from some scientists as well.
Well, you do. You'll hear about it from me. Awe is... that's a hard one to put exactly into words, but it certainly involves a sense of the mightiness and the splendor and almost indecipherable intricacy of something greater than ourselves. A lot of mysticism of religion arises directly from it, but it's equally experienced by the secularist whose mind opens to the splendor and intricacy of the material universe.
Well, part of the reason why I asked this is I've talked with some atheists who have suggested that what they really need is a spiritual atheism. They need this sense of awe. They're competing against the religious stories, the religious traditions that have been passed down over the eons with very powerful, emotionally powerful stories. Does the scientist, does the non-believer need that as well? Can the non-believer have that?
The answer to the second question is yes. The answer to the first question, do they have it, is usually no. The problem with secular humanism is that it does lack it.
Well, would you be comfortable in saying that science can have a sacred dimension?
Sacred, yes, in the sense of spirituality. The story of the origin of life on this planet, the time scale, the magnitude of it, the complexity of how it's put together, all of that together engenders in me probably even more awe than I ever felt as a devout young Southern Baptist growing up.
Let me ask you about that. You grew up religious, in a religious family.
Oh, yes. I grew up fundamentalist.
Fundamentalist?
Oh, yes. I grew up as a Southern Baptist with strict adherence to the Bible, which I read as a youngster. And I was warned by counselors that the truth was in the Bible. Redemption was only in Christ. And that the world is full of satanic force. Satan himself, perhaps, is certainly his agents, witting and unwitting, who would try to make me drop my belief. But no matter how lucid they sounded, I was told, no matter how compelling, no matter how smart they were, I was to say, in effect, you know, turn from me, thou Satan. And I had that instilled in me. You have to understand how powerful religious drive, the instinct, which I consider tribalist and really, but probably necessary in most societies for continuing day-to-day business.
Well, that's an interesting perspective. And basically you're saying it's necessary, but it's wrong.
Well, you see, in a way, that's the dilemma of the 21st century. That's possibly the greatest philosophical question of the 21st century. You could say that we evolved to accept one truth, you know, the religious instinct, but then discovered another. And having discovered another, what are we to do? You might say, well, it's just best to go ahead and accept the two worldviews and let them live side by side. I see no other solution. In fact, I believe they can put their different worldviews into position to solve some of the great problems, for example, of the environment. But generally speaking, the difficulty in saying they can live side by side is the sectarianism of the world today and the use of traditional religions to be exclusionary and to justify violence and war. And you just can't deny that this is a major problem.
So to return to your own personal history, when did you reject that early fundamentalist belief? When did you start to question the literal interpretation of the Bible?
One thing I did grow up at is an ardent naturalist since I was a little kid. I never grew out of my bug period, and so I just went on and learned more and more. By the time I got to college, I was steeped in natural history. I didn't learn much else in the high schools in Alabama, but I really was steeped in that.
So by the time of college, had you rejected that religious
background? Well, I learned, in college at the University of Alabama, I did begin to get a good education. But as soon as I got to the University of Alabama, I discovered evolution and the works of the new synthesizers of evolutionary theory. I read them all. This was an epiphany. I realized that all I had loved about the natural world and all I had learned now made sense. And that's what converted me.
Well, that's interesting because you're saying that you spent your whole youth out in the fields observing all of this. But in some ways, it didn't add up because you hadn't accepted evolution.
It didn't and it can't. That's the problem, is you cannot explain the patterns of diversity in the world, the geography of life, by any means except evolution. That's the one theory that ties it together. It's very hard to see that out of this will come traditionalist religious views to explain the meaning of life on this planet.
Well, let me follow up on that because I've heard you call yourself a deist.
Yeah, I don't want to be called an atheist.
Why not?
You know, being a good scientist and having been drawn up short so many times on my own theories, as all honest scientists are, I don't want to exclude the possibility of a creative force or deity. I think that would be a mistake to say that there is no God or supernatural force. And mark you well, I'm making a distinction here.
Right, I'm ready to pounce on this. So.
who started the creation. As Hans Kung, the theologian, once said, how are we to explain there is something and not nothing? Well, that's a question I'm happy to leave to the astrophysicist, but I do feel confident there is no intervention of a deity in the origin of life and humanity.
So that's the distinction between theism and deism. And so
that is the distinction so I'm not a theist, but I'll be a provisional deist.
But now, just so I understand this, to be a deist, you're saying that maybe there was some creator, some presence
That's not discounted yet as a hypothesis. That's why I put the word provisional.
But it's fascinating because everything that you've said up till now suggests that you should be an atheist. I mean, why sort of hold out that specter that, well, maybe there was some divine presence that got the whole thing going?
Well, because there's a possibility that a god or gods, I don't think it would resemble anything of the Judeo-Christian variety, or a super intelligent force came along, started the universe with a big bang, and then moved on to the next creation. I can't discount that.
Let's just play this out for a moment.
Yeah.
If there was this creative, whatever you want to call it,
divine intelligence.
All right. That got our universe going, what happened to that intelligence? Go off to the next universe?
Well, that's what I mean. That's exactly what I said.
Did it just sort of, 15 billion years either, ago, it left and went somewhere else?
Well, they're either now lurking on the outer reaches of the universe, watching with some amusement as the eons passed to see how the experiment worked out, or they moved on. Who can say?
I think this actually is is of great importance to, I mean, when we're talking about this whole question of science and religion, because there are a lot of people who discount the literal interpretation of the Bible. I mean, that does not square with modern science. And even when we start talking about God, I mean, that's such a loaded word. I mean, what if we put that word aside? Can we talk about energy, some sort of cosmic force?
I mean, well, that's why I say leave this. I leave this to the astrophysicist because they are the ones.
Not the religious scholars.
Hmm?
Not the religious scholars.
Oh, of course not. They don't know enough. Literally. I hope I'm not being insulting. But you can't talk about these subjects now without knowing a great deal of theoretical physics, particularly astrophysics. And developments in astronomy and so on, concerning the origins of the and evolution of the universe. But one thing we may very well be able to understand, start to finish, we haven't done it yet, is origin of life on this planet. And that's what counts for human beings. I take the view that the human species has evolved to be a biological part of this biosphere. We belong in this biosphere. We are intimately connected to it in our physiology, our psychology. And this planet actually can be a paradise if we use our intelligence to make it so.
You're sort of saying that humans have purpose here.
Yeah, they have purpose to live long and be happy.
More than that, they have purpose to be good stewards of this earth.
I believe so, yes. You know, when you unpack happiness into satisfaction, fulfillment, vision, awe, and I think it will be reached not by traditional religious faith, but it will be reached by knowledge and human self-understanding.
There are some people, as I'm sure you know, who talk about evolution, the theory of evolution, as a kind of secular religion. And the philosopher Michael Ruse has made this argument, for instance. He talks about evolutionism. If you want to talk about the identifying characteristics of a religion, sort of a complete, all-encompassing worldview with an origin story and all of that, you can find that in evolution.
Yeah. Maybe Michael, who's a friend of mine, was talking about me. Because I do often write in a spiritual tone, particularly in issues like biophilia, our natural relationship to the natural world, which is well-founded now, a psychological principle. But let me say something about scientists, including those who work on evolution. Basically, they don't worry about things like this. They're not uplifted in this manner. They are journeymen doing this. They are journeymen. They realize that the commerce of science is original discovery. That's our silver and gold. They won't talk in a conversation like the way we're having it now. They'll be talking about the latest findings of ecosystem organization in California tidal pools. And that's their world. They go home and they watch television. They may go fishing. And they may be learning Spanish in order to take the family to Guatemala. But basically, they are journeymen. There are relatively few people who are doing anything remotely like a spiritual search.
You're saying scientists, for the most part, don't have existential crises.
That's correct. They're not religious, particularly most of them. Mm-hmm. They're quite happy with what they have. Therefore, scientism, or science as an alternative religion, is not, in my opinion, a valid comparison. I don't see that as having the qualities of a religion, particularly as in terms of obeisance to a supreme being or of an urge to proselytize.
If, in some miraculous way, there was proof that there was a transcendental plane out there, would you find that comforting?
Sure. You know, let me take this opportunity to dispel the notion, the canard, that scientists are against transcendentalism. That is, that they want to block any talk about it. If any evidence whatsoever, any positive evidence could be found of a supernatural guiding force, there would be a land rush of scientists. What scientists would not want to participate in what would be one of the greatest discoveries of all time. Scientists are not against it. They're simply saying, particularly in reference to intelligent design, that it's not science and it's garbage until some evidence or some working theory is produced.
But I guess I'm asking the question in a slightly different way of you, and sort of you personally. Would you like there to be evidence of God? I mean, forget about this as a great scientific discovery, but just personally. I mean, given all of your background, mm-hmm. and would that be thrilling? Would that be comforting?
Well, it would certainly give you a lot of material to study and think about the rest of your time. But now, you didn't ask me the right question.
What's the right question?
The right question is, would I be happy if I discovered that likely I could go to heaven forever? And the answer is no. And the reason is, that's forever. Well, think about what is forever. And then think about the fact that the human mind, the entire human being, is built to last a certain period of time. Our programmed hormonal systems and regulations, the way we learn, the way we settle upon beliefs, and the way we love are all temporary. They are temporary because we are organisms. We go through a life cycle. Now, if we were to be plucked out at the age of 12 or 56 or whenever and taken up and said, now you will continue your existence as you are. We're not going to blot out your memories. We're not going to diminish your desires. You will exist in a state of bliss, whatever that is, forever. And those who didn't make it are going to be consigned to darkness or hell. Now think, a trillion times a trillion years, enough time for universes like this one to be born, explode, form countless star systems and planets, and then fade away to entropy. You will sit there watching this happen millions and millions of times, and that will just be the beginning of the eternity that you have been consigned to bliss in this existence.
This heaven would be your hell.
Yes. So if we were able, say, to evolve into something else, then maybe not, but we are not something else.
I think that's a very good place to leave it. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk it out.
E.O. Wilson talking with Steve Paulson. Wilson's books include Sociobiology and Consilience. He recently edited a collection of Charles Darwin's books called From So Simple a Beginning. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, we'd love to hear from you. Just email us through our website at ttbook.org. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program called Between Belief and Unbelief, number 326A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Doug Gordon, Anne Strainchamps, Veronica Rickert, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.